Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop, which was just voted best bookshop in Philadelphia, which we're really proud of. And, you know, I used to go through all the different search engines you could find us on, but now, as you know, in the past, I've said, just Google us. Because for whatever reason, we come up on the top of the search engine, and it'll show you our Facebook page, our YouTube channel, that you can go to iTunes and find all the podcasts, and it's well over 230 authors now, that you can find all of them on iTunes or on Podomatic. Today, we're really lucky to have with us Cy Montgomery. Cy is a graduate of Syracuse in 1979. She's been called a cross between Indiana Jones and Emily Dickinson. She's a naturalist, a conservationist. Her books include Encantado, Pink Dolphin of the Amazon, Search for the Golden Moon Bear, Spell of the Tiger, which was a National Geographic television documentary. And I could go on and on. She's written tons of children's books. She's written The Good, Good Pig, Quest for the Tree Kangaroo, which is an expedition to the cloud forest of New Guinea that was a recipient of numerous awards. But in any event, today we're here to talk about her new book, The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness, which is a great title, and we'll go into that. And it was just published last month. So, Cy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure having you here.
Oh, Sam, I'm thrilled to be on with you, and congratulations about the store.
Yeah, it was really a nice honor, and it's made a big difference. You know, it's hard running an independent bookstore now, as you must know, and it's nice because no matter how much stuff I have on the internet, most of it's still going to be word of mouth,
and that's right.
And that really helped out a lot.
Well, what a resource for your town, boy!
It's fun. It's a labor of love. It's never going to be my nest egg for my retirement.
Oh, you're my hero.
Well, and you are my heroine because I'll tell you though, I am angry at you for a couple of things. One is because I got caught up in the book so much that last night I ended up thinking, you know, I think I'll watch a YouTube video about octopuses.
Oh boy, that's slippery slope, isn't it?
Mucusy,
2 hours
literally mucusy, and figuratively, yes, 2 hours later, exactly, because they were all so fascinating. And the second thing is, why don't you tell me and tell our listeners, because all my life I've been saying octopi, and one of the first things you say in your book is why that's wrong. So why don't you tell
us? I know, it's very upsetting.
I know.
Apparently, you can't put a Latin ending, the plural being I, on a Greek word like octopus. But there's still use for the word octopi. And my friend recently baked me one. No, it doesn't have octopus in it. But what you do is, like, you just put tentacles all over the crust that adds all kinds of appeal.
What about platypi? And that doesn't work either? So all the pies?
I don't know if platypus is, in fact, I don't know. I know is that apple pie still works.
That's pretty funny. Well, you know, we could talk about Athena and Octavia and Callie, who are the octopuses in your book, who you actually had interactions with. But before we do that, you have great photographs in the book too. But what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about, what fascinated me was the fact that this creature that seems as if it was dropped from another solar system into our oceans. The neurological aspects of it, its defenses, its coloration, its camouflage, its emotions, and your conclusions regarding its consciousness. So, I mean, that's a lot of stuff. But if you could give us a background into what you already knew and what you've learned doing all this stuff, because it's such an incredible creature.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you really would have to go into science fiction or into outer space to come up with an animal more different from us than an octopus. They are a marine invertebrate. They have no bones at all. They can taste with all of their skin. They can pour their boneless bodies through a tiny opening. A 100-pound octopus can squeeze itself through an opening the size of an orange. and they have venom, and they have ink, and they have superpowers, extremely strong animals. A single sucker on a big male giant Pacific octopus, and they have 1,600 of them, can lift 30 pounds. A small octopus known as the, it's called Octopus vulgaris. It sounds like it swears at you, but this is called the common octopus, different species, much smaller. To pry it loose takes a quarter ton of force. So these guys are extremely strong, and they can, of course, change color and shape as well. So on top of all of that, adding to all of these alien superpowers, you have quite an intellect. These animals are very smart, and we know they are smart because, one, you can train them like you train a dog. Two, we know that they recognize individual humans because this has been proven by experiment. Three, they love to play with stuff. They play with the same toys we give our children. They love Legos, and they love Mr. Potato Head. They can unscrew jars. They can even open the childproof caps that most PhDs can't do on, you know, those pill bottles. You know, poor person, you have arthritis, and you can't open the top of it. Well, happily, just hand it to an octopus, and they'll take care of that for you.
Talk about the three-box situation. That was amazing, that the three-box.
Oh, yeah. This was really cool. Well, there's been an octopus enrichment manual created to keep octopuses occupied and telling you different things that you can do to make your octopus not get bored. But at New England Aquarium, the person who they tasked with coming up with some interesting challenge for an octopus was Wilson Menashe. He was an inventor with many patents to his name. And what he came up with was a series of three locking boxes, each one plexiglass. And the first one, and there's see-through plexiglass, had a lock on it. And first you'd put a live crab, the octopus's favorite food, in there. And the octopus would unlock it. Then he had another box, and he put the second box on the out, and put the first box inside the second box. And it had a different lock. So the octopus had to unlock two boxes, both of which had different locks. And then Wilson devised a third box. And this box had not one, but two different locks. So to get to the crab, the octopus had to unlock four total locks and learned how to do it extremely rapidly.
Yeah, when I read that, I was like, I'm thinking, it's like walking around with 10 Swiss Army knives.
I know. It's unbelievable. They've even taught an octopus to take, this is not at our aquarium, at New England Aquarium, but in New Zealand, there's an octopus whose name is Rambo, a female, who they've taught to take pictures of patrons in the aquarium. And how the octopus does this is that the people move and stand in front of a background, and the octopus rushes forward and is given access to this tube into which she puts one of her arms to press a red button, and that takes the picture.
There was one of the YouTube things that I unfortunately, or fortunately, ended up till 3 o'clock in the morning watching, and it was one where the octopus actually steals the video camera from the diver.
Oh, right, that's hilarious. They love to steal your stuff. I mean, that's a problem. Some people also discover that the octopus wants, if you're diving, to play with your regulator. They don't want to hurt you, but they don't realize that you need the regulator, but sometimes they take it out of your mouth. But happily, if you're a scuba diver, you know that you always have a second air supply, which, interestingly, is called an octopus.
That's right. I didn't even think of that.
Are you a diver?
I'm certified, but I have these inner ear problems, so I can't really dive. It's not worth the risk at my age.
Oh, man.
I'd love to do it.
Well, I bet you really identified with my scuba chapter.
Yep.
Because I had terrible ear problems myself. But happily, I was able to overcome them, and I was able to go both to Mexico and to Morea to swim with wild octopuses for part of my research. And the Morea expedition became its own little book for young people. Did you know about that book?
No.
This is called The Octopus Scientists, and it's part of a series of books that, with Nick Bishop, I invented in 1999 for Houghton Mifflin called Scientists in the Field. It's a whole series of books that you go with scientists into the field. We've been to Mongolia to study snow leopards, and we've been to Papua New Guinea, that book you mentioned earlier, looking at tree kangaroos, and I went to French Guiana with tarantula scientists and into a snake pit with 18,000 snakes. Anyway, so The Octopus Scientist is a book in that series for young readers.
And Nick Bishop's been
grades 4 through 8.
He's been your photographer for years, I guess.
Yeah, Nick has. But for Underwater, I'm working with another person named Keith Ellenbogen, because Nick is strictly terrestrial.
Got it. Well, yeah, that was. I'm trying to think. That one book, yeah, The Snake Scientist, right? That was the first.
Yeah,
one of the first ones.
We started the whole series with that, and then Nick and I did all these other wonderful adventures together. And then when I went underwater, I actually did ask Nick, "Hey, Nick, you want to learn underwater photography?" And he said, "Yeah, no, that might take a while," but happily, I found Keith, who's based in New York, and he's been diving since he was a teenager. And it's helpful too, because if I begin to drown, he can rescue me.
Yeah, it's much better to have an underwater photographer than a terrestrial one rescuing you when you get into a situation like that.
That's right.
All they can do is hand you a line. One of the amazing things, and again, watching it last night, is the ability of an octopus to change its color and to immediately like meld into a coral reef, and then as soon as it sees someone coming, to turn white and rush away. Talk
right.
a little
Did
bit about...
Did you see that Roger Hanlon video?
Yep.
And man, that's amazing.
It's actually unbelievable. But it's based on, talk about the three layers that allow an octopus to combine those three layers to create all this different color diaspora.
Right, right. They have three different kinds of cells that allow them to change color, and some of them are iridescent. Some of them reflect light passively. But most of them are under the octopus's voluntary control. And the chromatophores are like little drawstring purses that when you open them up, a big circle of that color will appear. And there's 5 million of those responsible for camouflaging the eyes alone. So imagine the kind of brain and nervous system that you'd need to process all of this stuff going on. When you're changing color, you're changing shape, you're looking at your predators, you're looking at your prey, you might be trying to escape from someone, hide from somebody, or use your color change to make your prey believe that you're something that you're not.
It's funny because when I read it, I was thinking, you know, if I didn't know that this was right, I wouldn't believe anything you were saying.
No, it sounds totally like a science fiction alien, doesn't it?
And then you talk about, you know, that the octopus has a relative that has no brain. And then you talk about our common ancestor, which is basically like a tiny little worm. And then immediately we branch off from each other.
That's right. We have 500 million years of evolution separating us. And that's what makes it all the more amazing, that you can be friends with an octopus.
Well, that's, I guess...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because it's in your title... You know, because your title is based on this wonder of consciousness. And you talk a little bit about other creatures and how in the past some of our philosophers, and it's nice that you can go back to the Greeks and still learn that they had these same opinions about octopuses. But what I found interesting is that, you know, in the past people didn't think, you know, birds, dogs, cats were aware of their own existence. And that's what, you know, what it's all about, is this awareness. And you are... I mean, you're so enthusiastic. Some people might think you're really over the top about this. How can she know, like when you reach your hand in to this freezing cold weather water and you freeze your hand and all these suckers are on you, why does that give you the idea when you scratch a head and it's soft and pleasant and all that? Where does that give you the idea that there's an awareness? That's the hardest part for me to comprehend, I guess.
Well... First, you certainly know that they are aware that you're an individual and that they recognize you. You experience that, and also, you know, there have been very well-documented experiments. Jennifer Mather and Roland Anderson did experiments with identically dressed people, making sure that octopuses recognized individual humans and behaved differently towards those that they liked and trusted. So that's something that Aquarius have known for ages, but that scientists did not. So we know that they're certainly aware of who you are. As far as, you know, their sense of self, this is an interesting question. Consciousness presupposes in many forms. I mean, consciousness is one of those things that constantly gets redefined, but one of the things that it tends to presuppose is that you do have a sense of self. I think the octopus's sense of self can be very different from ours. And one reason for that is that 3/5 of their neurons are not in their brains as ours are, but they are in their arms. And it's almost as if each arm is a separate creature.
Oh, talk about how if you sever one arm, how it thinks it's still alive and it tries to feed itself, but there's no place to put it.
That's right. I've certainly never seen this happen, and I would never sever an octopus's arm, even though they can regrow it. But if an octopus's arm is severed, it can go off and do stuff for many minutes, including hunt and catch prey, apparently.
That's amazing.
But, of course, what you would normally do if you were attached, you would pass that from sucker to sucker to sucker like a conveyor belt toward the mouth, which many people don't realize is in the octopus's armpit, or armpits, because you've got 8 of them. But if you've been severed, you can pass it all the way you want, but you're not going to meet the mouth, so that's too bad for that octopus. But philosophers who discuss this, like Peter Godfrey Smith, who is a fabulous guy. I met him when he was at Harvard. Now he's down in New York. He's studied octopus as well as cuttlefish, and he feels that they may have a much more diffuse sense of self or possibly a sense of multiple selves. And some research indicates that octopuses may have some bold arms and some shy arms.
Wow.
Does that blow your mind?
Yeah, well, what else blows my mind is you have this giant Pacific octopus, and it lives for 4 or 5 years. You know, you have all this mass that's created from this tiny grain of rice, and it doubles and doubles and doubles, and you have this gigantic thing, and then it doesn't hang out that long. Nope, no pun intended.
I know. And it's so different from most intelligent creatures that we're, you know, commonly think of.
Right.
Humans have long lifetimes. Apes have relatively long lifetimes. Whales have relatively long lifetimes. You know, dolphins, the animals that we think of as that we think of as being very, very smart. And also, the animals we think of as being smart tend to be social. But octopuses are neither long-lived nor social. So that begs the question, what is this intelligence for?
Yeah.
And Dr. Jennifer Mather, whose work I just mentioned a little earlier, the psychologist based at Lethbridge in Canada, says that this is probably because the octopus's ancestors had shells and they do not. So in place of the shell, that, you know, a shell protects you. The animals who have shells don't have to be highly mobile, generally. They just hang out and their food kind of comes to them, or they can go slowly to get their food. But an octopus is a packet of unprotected protein, and it has so many different predators and also capable of eating such different prey that it needs to be really smart, both to escape from its enemies and to find its food. And that, she says, is what has given them their smarts, a totally different thing from what gives us our smarts.
But they do have more defenses than lots of creatures, maybe even us, because they have neurotoxin, they have ink, they can spray their water.
Have to decide when to deploy it. So it's as if, you know, I've got a slingshot and a Bowie knife and some pepper spray and a getaway car and, you know, I've got all these things. But I've got to know when to use what. And that's the case with the octopus. And I think that, too, is what gives them their social smarts, even though they tend to be solitary. And there are species, as you know, there's 250 different species or more of octopus. They're discovering new species every day, it seems. My friend Tatiana Leyte, who is in both The Soul of the Octopus and the kids' book, too, as an octopus scientist, she's discovered several new species of large octopus right off the coast of Brazil where she lives.
Wow.
And so there's lots of different kinds, but most of them do appear to be solitary, although one of the ones that was recently rediscovered, the lesser Pacific striped octopus, mm-hmm. I hope it's that one. It might be the larger Pacific striped octopus. Anyway, one of these does appear to live in groups, but most of them are solitary, which makes you wonder, well, why would they want to be friends with us? They don't even want to be friends with other octopuses. What are they doing making friends with us? But I think the reason that might be is because of this flexibility that they have to be able to observe and make decisions about many different other species and decide, is this going to be a tasty morsel or is this thing going to attack me? And what might it do next? You know, there's this, it's called theory of mind, the ability to wonder what someone else might think and that they might think something different from yourself. If you are a hunter, it serves you well to have theory of mind, to be able to project, you know, gee, is this deer going to run from me over this way, or is he going to go that way? Or, you know, if you're being stalked by a Smilodon, you know, what's my predator going to do? What's he going to want to do? And you kind of have to put yourself in their shoes or hooves or claws or paws. Well, I think that octopuses do this routinely and that this equips them to be good friends. Because really, what makes a better friend than someone who's interested in what you're doing?
That's what's so... I mean, every single thing about octopuses that you wrote seems not... I don't mean it alien in that sense, but just the fact that, like, Athena, you know, poor Athena is dying, but they reach senescence, like they have almost like Alzheimer's, and then they become disinterested, they hide, they're not... And it's really weird because they have this short lifespan, but they still get to a point where they begin to get old.
Yes. And, I mean, in humans, of course, becoming senescent or certainly, you know, getting Alzheimer's doesn't happen to everyone, but it does happen to every octopus. And that I think, is just tragic and compelling.
And while we've talked about it, but I still don't get why their lifespans are short. I understand what you're saying about a carapace or something like that. Or like the sea star. Is it the sea star that hangs out with them? I forgot.
Yeah.
Like the
sea stars live a long time.
Yeah.
The sea stars get to see many octopuses. And you know, a little boy asked me the other night at the New England Aquarium when I gave a talk there. He actually asked the last question of the whole evening. And he said, why do they live so short? And I said to him, you know, I asked God the same question. It seems terrible, first of all. Why can't they live longer? But, you know, my hope is that to the octopus may have had so many interesting experiences and rewarding relationships and delicious meals and exciting escapes that maybe at the end of her short 3 to 5 years, she feels as if she has had a long and eventful and meaningful life.
That's true. I mean,
it might not seem...
It's so relative. I mean, time is such a relative concept for all living things. I think that, you know, that's why everyone says live in the moment. And you can live in a moment that seems to be eternity. So, but like I said, it just seems there is so much about them that must be unknown. Obviously, you know that. Mm-hmm. But there's so much about them that's almost beyond fascinating. It's just like, in the sense of, I don't understand this. I don't understand how you can put them on a checkerboard and they look like a checkerboard.
Yeah, right. Unbelievable.
Or how you
they
can...
They don't actually make checks, but they do become invisible.
Yeah.
And that teaches us a lot about how camouflage works. You know, To be camouflaged, you don't have to look exactly like your substrate.
You have to
look like something else, not yourself.
Yeah.
You just have to not call attention to yourself, which is very interesting to me.
Well, we're essentially talking about empiricism, and so what they're really doing, and this is another sign of amazing intelligence, is they're fooling you into not seeing them, which is...
And so to fool you, they have to first understand what you believe.
Right, exactly.
And also to see when the ruse has failed. So, you know, an octopus, if one thing doesn't work, if turning white doesn't work, they'll try something else. They'll change, they'll do another color or another pattern, or they'll jet away, or they'll squirt out ink. You know, they're constantly making these evaluations of, you know, does this individual that I'm interacting with at this moment, what do they believe?
It is mind-boggling. It's almost like, well, they should rule the world. They have all this stuff going on if they were on land. Talk about how they escape from everything and how they will even, you know, hang out on land to go somewhere else. That's amazing, which is also amazing.
Well, I mean, part of the reason that octopuses, they're famous for getting out of their tanks in aquaria. And in my book, I talk about one of the dearest, most lovely, fun, sweet octopuses who did this, and it ended in tragedy. But octopuses famously escape their enclosures, and they often end up in an adjacent tank having eaten the inhabitants. At the Seattle Aquarium, at one point, they have a very, very large tank, and they had an octopus in there, and they also had some sharks. And they were very scared, like, oh, gosh, oh, the shark's going to hurt the octopus. Well, then the sharks started turning up dead. Turned out that the octopus was preemptively killing the sharks, not eating them, just thinking like, you know, I don't really want this mugger living in my neighborhood. I think I will kill him. But anyway, their ability to escape is amazing. Did you see the video of the one on the ship?
Yes,
that caught in a net, and he just decided he'd leave, and they videoed it.
Yep.
And you're so rooting for the octopus, too, you know. He gets out of there. And having that nice coat of slime really helps you, because at times, you do need to get out of the water. A number of octopuses will hunt briefly on land. They might have to travel to an adjacent tide pool, for example, to find a tastier crab or to escape a predator. And they're not above even hunting birds. They have been known to grab birds who are flying low over the ocean out of the sky to eat them.
So if you go back to that video, when I was watching it, I'm looking at him, and it's like he stops for a second, and it's almost like you can see him thinking, let's see, which way, okay, yeah, I'll go this way, and then I'll come back the other way, and now I can see how I can get off. It's like, and the guys, you can tell, but you can just see the boots of the guys, and you can tell they're just watching this, either laughing.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I love that.
But it's just the idea, and even like one side note, like you talk about mucosa, about the idea of mucus, and you know, laughingly, because I guess who was it you were with that was really worried about?
Oh, this was my friend Jody Simpson.
Yeah.
We were walking our dogs together, and she was saying, like, oh, isn't slime gross? And I'm like, well, no, slime, we need slime for two of the happiest activities in the life of a human, after all. And she said, what's the second one? And I said, eating. So, you know, slime is very useful. But that is what lets an octopus come out of the water and survive for minutes at a time.
Yeah, which is also unbelievable. You know,
it's also what helps them squeeze into these little openings, too. It helps to have that lube going on. They can just collapse their bodies, but then they're kind of greasing their way through.
Yeah, there's all kinds of...
You know, when you're touching them, it doesn't feel icky at all. They feel soft and they feel slippery, but they don't feel like, oh, yuck, you know, I just sneezed on my hand. It's not like that at all.
Well, it's like, you know, I understand they have no bones, and I understand that they can twist themselves or make themselves into all these different shapes. But when you see them going through these small passages, it's almost unbelievable that they can do what they do. Which goes back again to my idea that, hey, they really should rule the world, you know.
Well, I think if they did, there'd be a lot less pollution, for example, and fewer wars.
Well, that's why I always think that dolphins are probably smarter than us. Our problem is we're able to manipulate the environment, which allows me to talk to you because we can invent all this stuff. Dolphins have no appendages that allow them to manipulate the environment, so all they can do is think. So
right.
I think that they're smarter because they can think cosmic thoughts all the time and express.
That's right. It's very, very Buddha-like, I guess, to have a more intellectual and spiritual existence, whereas we're always poking and prodding.
We always have a screwdriver in our hand and we're turning something.
Yeah.
And if we didn't
have...
Although,
boy, if you gave an octopus a screwdriver, I don't want to see what's going to happen there.
Yeah, that's when you talk about the bottles that you give them and how they play with them. And talk about the squirting behavior, which is another defense mechanism.
Oh yeah, this is so cool, and they can use it for different things. You know, an octopus jets through the sea using its funnel, and this is this flexible funnel on the side of the head, and it can go on either side. They can move it all the way around, and actually for many weeks I believed that it was just on the right side of the head, and then I thought, oh no, I'm wrong, it's just on the left, but they can move it any way they want, and they can aim it with extreme accuracy, and they use it as well as to travel to shoot blasts of water at stuff for various reasons. And why would you want to blast water at stuff? Well, it's great for repelling things. If in front of your den there's a bunch of detritus and you'd like to wash it, you know, whoosh it away like a leaf blower, you can use your funnel to repel that. If you're a mother sitting on your eggs and you want to make sure that they're not getting dirty, you can blast your eggs with your funnel to clean it. But one thing that octopuses do is that they will also hit people right in the face with a hose of freezing cold salt water, and I think that they think this is pretty amusing at times. I've been with several people who were hosed by an octopus.
Yeah, that one student that came, but she liked it though.
She liked it. She thought it was hilarious. And also, Danny, remember my friend's brother, a young volunteer at the aquarium, brought in her twin brother, and he knew a lot about octopuses, but he was also afraid of them because he had seen all these scary movies and stuff in which they're attacking you. And as a surprise for his birthday, we offered him a chance to touch one, and he was scared, and he was actually shaking. And the octopus, even though she was very friendly, she wasn't really interacting with him until she blasted him in the face with salt water. And that essentially acted as an icebreaker for Danny. And after that, Danny wasn't afraid to play with her, and she was happy to play with him. So sometimes they may use it to play. And there was another volunteer at the aquarium who, this particular octopus, would always blast her and only her. And I had written about this in a magazine article I did before I did the book in Orion magazine. And she contacted me and said, I just want you to know that everything you wrote was accurate. And she did blast me in the face. But that octopus didn't do it because he disliked me. I think he did it because he did like me. And that is also possible.
Well, it's like
they use their jets to play. And we know that because Roland Anderson documented one octopus that was using its jet to send a pill bottle into a stream of water. He would use his jet to blast this into a stream of water in the tank, knowing that that stream of water would then bring the pill bottle right back to him, and he could blast it with his jet again. And this went on for 20 times. And it was just like a kid bouncing a basketball against the side of the wall.
Yeah, that was the image I got when I read that, or else playing with bubble soap or something like that, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's the idea, you know, that you can modulate the strength of it and, you know, the where you're sending it. And it's just another one of these things that we've ticked off that are, really amazing. And,
yeah.
Well, so what did, you know, out of all of this, and I know you've done this same type of exercise with all kinds of creatures all over the world and in dangerous places and all that, But, I mean, and I know you love these creatures. And like I said, you know, your enthusiasm is infectious. But it's like, so out of all this, and you have Sally, your dog, there with you. And, you
yes,
know,
you heard.
And yes, and you wanted, you know, you tried to get an octopus in your house, but your husband and you had some differences about that. But do you really think of them as like, you do think of them as your friends when you interact with them, don't you?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Very much
so.
And you feel more privileged to know a mind so unlike yourself. You know, it's interesting. I did a book on Temple Grandin, who you know is a famous designer, professor, author, and she's autistic. And her autism is a great boon to her because her brain is so different. She's able to see things in ways that the rest of us with our average brains can't see. And one of the reasons I particularly treasure her friendship and loved writing that book about Temple Grandin is, as she says, we need all kinds of minds out there to make the world interesting. And for me, getting to know the mind of someone as different as an octopus is extremely rewarding for that very reason. I mean, and when I say getting to know this mind, I mean, there's so much I don't know. But just being able to touch that mind, being able to have that kind of a friend, it just expands your universe so powerfully. And it lets you dwell in the realm of the possible to an extent that I would never be able to do if I were just surrounded by a regular
us.
Homo sapiens just like myself.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because... I firmly believe that we should be exploring the universe looking for extraterrestrial consciousness. I think that's great what we're doing, and we should spend more resources on it. But at the same time, I wonder if we encountered somewhere on Titan, say there's underground oceans, if we encountered an intelligence like this, like you propose, how we would treat it and how it would treat us, whether we would be smart enough to recognize it not as an enemy but as a possible friend. And I don't think the human race is equipped to do that.
Well, when you think of how long it has taken us to even accord the great apes, who are so closely related to us, you can get a blood transfusion from a chimp, it's taken us, and we still haven't fully accorded them the dignity of personhood. You know, we treat, in our actual treatment of chimpanzees, it is perfectly legal to take a chimpanzee who never did anything wrong and put him in jail for the rest of his life.
Right.
You know, and people do medical experiments on innocent beings like that. And knowing that they're so like us.
I mean, they share more than what, you know, more than 99% of our DNA.
Exactly. And if we're doing this to the great apes,
you're right,
who are so like us, you know, how are we going to treat other intelligences that we encounter on other planets? When we can't even recognize on our own planet the intelligence of creatures, even creatures who will speak to us in plain English, like birds, like parrots. Parrots can speak to us meaningfully in English and tell us what they think. And true, sometimes they're just parroting stuff because they like the sound of it, like some, you know, teenagers singing the lyrics of their favorite song, even though the lyrics are really stupid. You know, we all do that. But, you know, meanwhile, we've got birds who tell us their feelings in plain English, and look at how we can treat them.
And you haven't even touched upon the fact that we have half of America, maybe not half, that are still, you know, teaching that evolution is a theory, or that intelligent design is, you know, the God planet, the fossils to test our faith or something like that. So there's a lot of inertia that you would have to overcome before you could even begin. You know, we're the dumb
yeah.
ones is what I'm saying. We're the dumb
exactly,
ones.
Exactly, exactly. But you know what I think is so odd to me about people who feel so offended by evolution is, you know, if you read stuff Jesus said, he spoke to us in parables. It's a really good way to get across a truth. And if you read Genesis, the main truth that it gets across to me is that we and all the rest of life on this beautiful planet are related. We're family. And that's the take-home message of evolution as well. So no one is refuting the other's central truth. There's no disagreement there. Someone's picking a fight where there really doesn't need to be one.
Well, we are. And, you know, I was talking before with one of the other broadcasters here, and he was talking about how he feels the Earth itself is an organism that lives and breathes and thinks. And I was thinking, me being the fatalist I am, was thinking, yeah, I think the Earth is kind of pretty much sick of us. Looking at us as a parasite and saying, you know, I got to get rid of these guys. You know, they've reached the point.
I know. But, you know, I'm hoping that we may be on the cusp of an exciting new time. I have seen just within my lifetime, I'm only 57 years old, but just in my lifetime, I've seen a real change. I could not have written this book. No one would have published it, I don't think, 30 years ago.
No, you're right.
But I can write it now and give it a title, The Soul of an Octopus, and a major publisher will publish it, and it'll appear in bookstores all over the United States. And, I mean, it's intriguing because we tend not to think of a marine invertebrate having a soul. But being invited to think of that is an invitation I think a lot of readers are going to accept.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, it's, yeah, granted, you're a naturalist. I would call you a scientist. But it's not a book that someone picks up. It's not a book that I would pick up simply because I'm interested in scientific literature. It's a book that, and also, I think it's a great title, too.
I'm so glad you like it.
Yeah, I mean, it really does, because if you didn't say The Wonder of Consciousness, I don't think as many people would be interested in it as they are. And I think people are fascinated by the concept of consciousness, which I look at as a kind of, I don't know, hybrid between this idea of self-awareness and the willingness to share your experiences with somebody else, no matter who that might be. And I think people identify with that very closely. But you're right. They would never have thought, that thought process would not have arisen 50 years ago.
Yeah, and I think also, I'm hoping that this book reaches a number of readers in that it, you know, that it is not a scientific treatise per se, and that while we're doing this exploration, the way I'm doing the exploration is using my relationships with these animals as a tool of inquiry. This is it's a long love story. It's a narrative about how I came to know these particular individuals and the adventures that we had together and the truths we explored and that they revealed. And although there is a lot of scientific data in there, and I worked with a number of scientists, it's primarily a narrative and primarily a story of how knowing and being friends with these animals changed my life
and that's
my thinking.
And that's why it was so good that, and we're running out of time, but that's why it's so good that you started the book with three chapters about actual individuals, Athena, Octavia, and Callie, because mm-hmm. that really, here's three people that you met. Rather than starting
it. Yeah. I'm so glad you got that. Yeah. Well, that's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I did. And I couldn't wait to introduce you know how you want to introduce your friends to your friends?
Exactly.
That's how I felt when I was writing this book.
And that's how I felt when I was reading it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, that makes me feel like $1 million.
Well, I'm glad. Well, and also, and then we'll leave with this, I really like the cover, too, because whoever drew that and the background really gives you it's like a kind of a good feeling. Also, you know, owning a bookstore, you can say 1,000 times that don't judge a book by its cover, but everyone who comes in, the first thing they do is judge a book by its cover. And, right, don't you think so?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important.
Yeah, so I think whether you vetted this or came up with it or whoever did come up with it, it's a really good one. It draws you in, don't you think?
I do, but I've got to admit to you, when I first saw it,
I know what you thought.
I just was taken aback. This is the only book, well, with one exception, a book I did called Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo about a real-life famous cockatoo that had art on the cover. All my other books have photographs on the cover, so I was expecting a photograph. And instead, there's this beautiful piece of artwork. And so I was taken aback.
This is better.
But the reason they chose not a photograph is they felt that a photograph would be off-putting. A photograph of an animal covered with suckers and slime and would be upsetting. Whereas this kind of invites the reader with those waving arms, an octopus that seems to be floating either in heaven or in the sea, and beckoning the reader to come in, and they can later encounter the suckers in the arms.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, at first glance, you might say, or you might say, oh, this is just a static image, which it is, and that doesn't tell you a lot about the creature because it's static, and it's the most dynamic creature I've ever seen. But I think it gives you this idea of not placidity, but this idea of benign benevolence towards you, and that's what I think is so good about it, especially, like I said, and you said too, the background.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, and I'm going to tell my editor, because working with the artist, I think they did come up with the absolute perfect cover, and I am thrilled with it.
Me too. Okay, well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you about this, and like I said, we have all these book clubs, and if you ever want to Skype into one of our book clubs, we would love to have you.
Sam, I would love that. I mean, just be in touch with me, and on goes the Skype. I would love to do that. And thank you, too, for being so kind about Sally adding her voice to our interview.
No, it was a pleasure. Tell her I said hi.
Okay. All righty, great.
All right, talk to you soon. That was Sy Montgomery talking about her book, The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness, published last month by Atria in hardback. So that was a fascinating foray into the consciousness of other beings. And as we talked about, you know, the octopus, as weird as it is, almost seems as if it's from another planet. Next week, we're going to have with us J.C. Holman discussing his latest work, Bee and Me, A True Story of Literary Arousal, which is a story about a love affair with an author in a literary sense. And it gives you a true insight into how you can, how you can find an author so fascinating that a portion of your life ends up being devoted to him. For a complete schedule of all our books, please go to our website or go to our YouTube station, and you'll be able to find everything you need. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we look forward to talking with you next week.